Judiciary, May 27th, 1985, Subcommittee 1, Public Hearing and Possible Work Session. Hospitals to be considered are 24, 29, 30, 06, 30, 30, Senate Bill 244, and House Bill 2331.
Just let me note a couple of things for the record. In terms of our procedure and materials we're going to be reviewing today, Council, were we able to get a hold of Mr. Geary, or do we know if he's going to be able to join us this afternoon?
Mr. Geary was here at the beginning of our afternoon session, and I advised him that I wasn't sure whether we were going to get to, House Bill 2331 today, and I told him that I would call him as soon as we knew that we were. I've made at least two phone calls, and I believe the Department of Justice is on vacation, and I wasn't able to reach him. And we asked Mr. Linden to see if he'd swing by his office and find Mr. Geary in the city would, but he didn't know that he could get into their portion of the building.
Okay. We do have a written statement from him, do we not?
We have a letter that has been passed out to committee.
Okay. Let me note, for those who are here, House Bill 3030 was just received by the committee. Representative Hill is on the floor and is carrying some bills and will not be able to actually join us this afternoon. He's requested that bill be reset for a hearing later in the week, and I've informed him that we would do that. So 3030 will be carried over, newly printed bill. Just for information public, we received some fiscal impact statements on the first two bills. We've got a 2429, and the bottom line is for 2429 with the proposed House amendments, shows a general fund impact of just over $1.5 million for 85-87, and an 87-89 general fund impact of almost $2 million. On House Bill 3006, the 85-87 fiscal impact is it goes from 17.8 to $14.7 million, and in 87-89 goes from 8.5 to $15.9 million. And I believe that sponsors of those who spoke to those bills may want to comment on the fiscal impact, but obviously, even if they're partially correct, the problem remains a ways and means referral. We're trying to tack down Major Madsen for Senate Bill 244. Let's go ahead and start with 2331, which is to be amended. And Council, I think, has some amendments, and we've got Mr. Sandrock and others here. So why don't we go ahead and start with 2331. Council?
If I may suggest to the Chair that House Bill 2331 has been tabled, do you wish to untable it before we...
Okay. This bill was tabled earlier, and the Chair would move to take 2331 from the table for the purposes of considering amendments from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Non-debatable motion. Are there any objections to removing 2331 from the table? If not, it's untabled. Thank you. Council?
Yes, I want to remind the committee that we have that we still have before the subcommittee House Bill 2594, which is the Victims' Rights Bill. In the Victims' Rights Bill, after several hours and actually several days of working on that bill, this committee adopted some consecutive sentencing standards in that bill. You have before you in 2331, there are amendments to 2331 in the form of it says House Bill 2126-1 amendments. It says House Bill 2331 at the top, and it's Legislative Council 845-521-85. Those are essentially the consecutive sentencing standards that are in Senate Bill 257, which is still on the Senate side. I spent some time today comparing the provisions that this subcommittee adopted in the Victims' Rights Bill that had to do with consecutive sentencing with these amendments that are here before you today, and at a later time perhaps we can discuss the differences and the similarities between those two bills.
Okay, Council, just where's the Victims' Rights Bill at this time?
The Victims' Rights Bill has been thoroughly amended. The amendments have been rewritten. It is set for a hearing on Wednesday before the full committee.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go ahead with 2331, and we have with us Pete Sandrock, ODAA, and also Ms. Hertzmark, if you want to come up at the same time.
Chair, for the record, Pete Sandrock of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm not sure into how much detail the Chair would like me to go with regard to the substance of what is presently in 257, or to compare it with what is in the Victims' Rights Bill. You may have gotten more thoroughly briefed than you would ever wanted to on these matters when you were hearing the amendments originally, but so I'm prepared to give you as much detail as you like. Or
let me start with a question, if I may. How do both of those provisions, what's been adopted by a subcommittee in the Victims' Rights Bill and 257, how do they compare to the bill which was passed by the House last session but failed on the Senate side?
They are comparable, although there are some differences. The differences, as I recall, are some more specific language to ensure that in the multiple victim case, an effort to make it very clear that those do not merge. And in the repetition of the same crime against the same victim, the language in 257 is more specific, but not the language in the Victims' Rights Bill as it now exists.
If you had to pick between the language in the Victims' Rights Bill and 257, which would you prefer?
257.
257. Okay. Why don't we go ahead then, if you want to maybe just briefly explain to us 257. And members have what appears to be proposed amendments of 2126. Just forget about 2126. That was originally thought to be a vehicle. 2331, in fact, is going to be the vehicle. So these are the amendments we have before us, which basically are Senate Bill 257.
A defendant during a single criminal episode may violate multiple statutes. For example, commit a burglary with intent to commit rape, may injure multiple victims. For example, the drunk driver who runs into a car with three people, or violate the same statute against the same victim multiple times. The State versus Garcia circumstance where the same victim was sodomized in three different ways over a 40-minute period of time. Current law permits the district attorney to charge multiple offenses, the jury to find the defendant guilty of multiple offenses. But the problem is that the courts are struggling with establishing rules to guide them in deciding how many judgments of conviction to enter. The courts say that they don't know what to do because they don't know whether multiple sentences are intended by the legislature or not. The courts have said time and time again that they are trying to divine legislative intent, but usually find it lacking. Lacking a clear reading of legislative intent about whether they should be imposing multiple convictions arising out of the same criminal episode, they have applied a rule of statutory construction. The fallback position for the courts is the so-called rule of lenity, which means that if the court doesn't know whether the legislature intended multiple convictions or a single conviction, then the court shall assume that the legislature intended the most lenient of the alternatives and to enter a single conviction. Now, this issue has been addressed multiple times prior to the 83 session. The Joint Interim Committee on the Judiciary's Task Force on Sentencing addressed it. They tried to tackle this very issue, but were unable to reach a final conclusion. During the 83 session, a substantially similar version of what we're talking about here today was introduced in the House. Representative Myers worked with all of the parties involved to try to hammer out some compromise language. There was ourselves and the defense, I think, ultimately agreed on the language regarding consecutive sentencing, did not agree on the language regarding merger. And let me explain to you that there's a difference between the concept of merger and the concept of consecutive sentencing. And it's very important in understanding the concept of this bill. Out of the same criminal episode, the defendant may have committed, as in Garcia, three separate sodomies. In that case, it was also a rape charge and a kidnapping charge. Jury found the defendant guilty of all five charges. The court imposed 20-year sentences on all five charges and ordered them to be served consecutively. The Court of Appeals said that because three of those charges were violations of the same statute, sodomy, there could only be one conviction for that sodomy charge. That defendant ended up with three 20-year sentences with consecutive sentences. That defendant obviously was treated rather harshly and probably appropriately so, but if there had only been the three sodomy charges in the case and not the kidnapping and rape charges as well, what would the court have been able to do? First, the merger concept would have prevented any more than one conviction, just one sodomy charge. This bill would say that the court could impose three separate convictions for sodomy because the victim was sodomized in three separate ways. The bill then establishes standards which the court must meet before it can impose consecutive sentences, and understand that right now there are no standards for consecutive sentences. The court can impose consecutive sentences whenever it wishes, so long as there are multiple convictions arising out of a single criminal episode. But you really can't address one issue without addressing the other. If you were to impose standards for consecutive sentencing without imposing rules for merger, then what you would do would be to decrease or limit the court's potential authority with regard to sentencing. You have to have, in our view, you have to have both concepts. We don't know what the ultimate impact of the bill on prison capacity will be, but at the outset, by permitting more convictions to arise out of the same criminal episode, we are not saying it, we are saying that that will not necessarily result in more people going to prison, because understand that if under present law, with multiple convictions or multiple guilty verdicts arising out of the same criminal episode, if that's somebody that the judge thinks should go to prison, the judge is going to send that person to prison right now. By creating new rules on merger, that threshold question isn't going to be answered any differently. The same defendant is going to go to prison. But what it does mean is that that defendant, in an appropriate case, may spend more time in prison because there will be more convictions. Because of the consecutive sentencing standards, built into the bill, however. We're saying that the people who go to prison for a longer time will be the ones who are going for the right reasons, the people who have caused greater injury and have evidenced a more callous disregard of the victim in the commission of their crimes. Hopefully, what we will be doing is forcing more rational choices in the allocation of our prison space. The more dangerous offender will be spending more time. It also means that some offenders will be spending less time, because some offenders who may accumulate multiple convictions out of the same criminal episode won't be eligible for consecutive sentences because the judge can't make the necessary findings on the record to support the consecutive sentences. We think that, as written, there are multiple safeguards for the defendant. First of all, and I think the greatest fear is that by permitting more convictions out of the same criminal episode, then DAs will be encouraged to become ever more zealous and ever more creative in the way they carve up the same criminal episode to create more charges. The safeguards against that overzealousness include the fact that the defendant still must be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge, and not the DA, decides whether to impose consecutive or concurrent sentences. The legislature creates the standards by which the judge can impose the consecutive sentences. And finally, if the parole board doesn't like the idea of a consecutive sentence, it can unstack it. And after the action of this legislature, the parole board will be able to consider bed space as an express consideration in the matrix. So there will be that safeguard as well. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Just quickly, Peter, as I read the amendments here, maybe counsel, it looks like we have the consecutive sentence, but it also looks like there are a couple sections devoted to notification to victims and an opportunity to participate in parole board. That's not really...
That's not our point in the bill.
We
added those as we were preparing the bill just because we weren't sure that those issues would get adequately addressed. They have been, so we don't consider that important for purposes of what we're trying to do.
Okay, I think this has probably been covered in the victim's bill previously. And I think I understand your concern is that because the victim's bill more than likely will have a referral to Ways and Means, you prefer to have a bill that just focuses on the consecutive sentencing issue and have that issue considered by itself on the floor and hopefully by both bodies. Is that a correct statement?
Hopefully, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think when I look at the criteria, what the court must find, over on page 2 starting on line 8, now I realize that the court has a great deal of discretion in terms of sentencing to consider factors and make findings of aggravation and mitigation, just as a parole board presumably has that. But I guess I need your advice, or like to hear your opinion. I know that when we start talking about sentencing and we talk about the death penalty, which I realize is it's a whole different ball game, it seems to me that one of the objections to earlier versions of the death penalty was that it was a court, not a jury, that made certain essential findings that were like aggravation or would trigger something. And I'm just kind of curious if do we need to consider that possibility here in terms of findings made by a court, not by a jury, that permit consecutive sentences to be imposed?
You're referring to the same problem that arose in State versus Wedge as well as State versus Quinn. And yes, we have some concerns along that line. although we believe that these kinds of findings are close enough to the kinds of findings that the courts traditionally have made in imposing any kind of sentence, that an appellate court would still permit those findings to be made by the court alone. And I know that last session the court certainly felt that this was the general direction that it wanted the legislature to go in terms of stating its intent. Regardless of where it came down on the substantive issue, this is where the court, I think, wanted the legislature to go.
Okay. Representative Kopeski?
Yeah, I was hoping that Mr. Sandrock might kind of help us out here a little bit in terms of what he thinks that the impact will be on plea bargaining. That's really the practical thing, a huge part of this that we really don't see in the statute.
Mm-hmm. I think that in any case in which the defendant's jeopardy increases, or potential jeopardy increases, then, or liability for sentence for time served, anytime that increases, then that obviously puts the prosecutor in a stronger plea bargaining situation.
So,
Representative Kopeski.
Yeah, I guess when you start talking about the impact on the jail or prison space, and addressing the, as you did earlier, the pluses, minuses, or trade-offs you see, that happens or occurs when you go to trial, but it doesn't address the whole issue of what's going to happen out there in terms of plea bargaining. We're going to see more pleas, probably. We're going to see more convictions probably involving a higher penalty or sentencing. Would that be fair?
No, I don't think that necessarily follows. I think that it does follow that defendants who perceive the possibility of an increased sentence are just necessarily going to look for ways to plead down to avoid that increased sentence. But still the court's going to have to make the necessary findings on the record as to whether a consecutive sentence can be imposed. Concurrent sentences are essentially meaningless to a defendant in terms of the time actually served in prison. Five burglary convictions with 20-year sentences each run concurrently still work out to the same sentence as for a single conviction. The DA is not, even in a plea, remember, even at the time of sentencing, the judge is going to have to make those findings.
But if they cop a plea on something, the judge doesn't have to find any of those findings.
The judge is still going to have to make the findings on the record. I think the ability of the prosecutor to sentence bargain for a consecutive sentence that wouldn't be supportable by findings on the record is going to be severely limited, because the DA is not going to be able to bargain away the facts or the defendant's prior record or lack of prior record.
Well, okay, let me think about this a little more. Mr. Chair, I've asked my legislative assistant, who's an attorney and worked over at the Supreme Court for a while, to do a comparison for me, and I'd be glad to share it with the committee in terms of think it's 257 in last session's bill. And, or
is this kind of a spreadsheet representing Kowalski?
Yes. Yeah. And what we did in the victim's rights bill. Try to get a picture of the differences.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the fact that I think you're asking to defer final action on this until Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yes.
Let's go ahead and take what other questions, but Ms. Hertzmark, did you want to make any statement at this time?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Marcy Hertzmark from Metropolitan Public Defenders. Mr. Sandrock is correct in that we spent an incredible amount of time on these issues last session. We basically, the parties involved, which do include just the defense and the prosecutors, but judges were also involved in those discussions. We did agree that the consecutive sentence concept, where there would be standards, was acceptable to all sides. We have some concerns with the 257 language, mostly on page 1, line 24, where it talks about an indication of the defendant's willingness to commit more than one criminal offense. We're a little concerned that we don't know what that means and how it will be interpreted as a bottom line consideration in whether a judge is to make findings as to consecutive sentence. And it's just a concern. We don't have any other language to substitute for that. This is something I wanted to bring up as a concern with the actual language and not the concept. The concept, on the other hand, the concept of the merger, we did not agree with. This particular language, though, came as close as we were going to come to agreeing to anything when we agreed not to agree. And if the committee did decide to go ahead with this, we would like to discuss perhaps the list of crimes that are involved that would be considered for merger. We have some problems with multiple burglaries, perhaps. There's. I'm sorry that Steve Jacobson, who is the lead attorney on this for us, is not able to be here today. But he did have some concerns with what crimes were included in that list, and we would like to be able to discuss that when we get, if you decide to go further on this measure. And we are willing to continue working on this issue because it is an unclear area of the law. We understand that. Nobody was really happy with Garcia, and we do need to come up with something, and I'll be glad to continue working on that issue.
Yeah. Are there further questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I suppose either one of you define a little more carefully or maybe give me examples of what you mean by merging? Would those be, you know, robbing five different people all at one time, and so that would all be merged into one robbery? I guess I'm looking for a clearer definition of merger.
Well, there are there are a lot of different variations. The question that you asked about robbing five different people, if the defendant went into the store and took property from five different people, then that is five different robberies. On the other hand, if the defendant became intoxicated and plowed into three pedestrians, that's one manslaughter or one negligent homicide, depending on how it's pled. If the defendant were, say, to break into someone's house with the intent to rape the occupant, and was frightened away by the victim, for example, she resisted enough to frighten him away, you could charge both the burglary and the attempted rape. Then at the time of sentencing, the prosecutor would be faced with a somewhat Hobson-like choice of asking the judge to impose the sentence on the attempted rape charge
which would be a Class B felony, but probably more clearly defines the nature of the offense, or ask that the sentence be imposed on the burglary charge, a Class A felony that carries the maximum penalty of 20 years as opposed to 10 years. Under this bill, in that circumstance, there would be a conviction for both burglary in the first degree and attempted rape. So it addresses situations in which multiple statutes are violated during a single criminal episode, during which multiple victims are injured or suffer loss, or the same victim is repeatedly violated in terms of the same statute, the rape and assault sort of situation.
Okay, I guess I'm still looking. Is the merger then, does that come from the fact it was both the 20-year and the 10-year sentence? I mean, maybe there isn't a clear definition of merger. Maybe that's the problem.
The